Well, we've come to the end of our studies in 1 Peter. We've gone through at quite a pace, and we're in the last chapter this morning, chapter 5. And there's something for everyone in this last chapter, and that's what I've called the talk, because I couldn't think of a better title for it. But there is something for everyone in this last chapter. Peter is really going to make his final kind of exhortation, but he has something to say to all of us. And so there are four things, and I'll tell you what they are, and if you're taking notes, you can actually, if you want to, take these points down. Four things in this chapter. There is, first of all, there is an appeal to our elders. So that should make you sit up and take notice. There is an appeal to our elders. Verses 1 to 4. Then secondly, there is a challenge to our ego, verses 5 to 7. And then thirdly, there is a recognition of our enemy, verses 8 to 11. And then finally, there is a PS for our encouragement. So those are the four things. An appeal to the elders, a challenge to the ego, a recognition of the enemy, and a PS for our encouragement. So without any more introduction, let me just get into those four points straight away. First of all, the chapter begins with an appeal to the elders, verses 1 to 4. And you might want to ask yourself, well, why does Peter begin this final chapter, this great rallying call, by appealing to the church leaders? Well, one suggestion, of course, is that if the church is going to go through tough times, as I believe it will for us in Australia, but I think it's already happening, as you're very well aware, all around the world right now. And Peter's hinted in the earlier chapters, particularly in chapter 4, that this church, this bunch of Christians scattered throughout these Roman provinces in modern-day Turkey, that it's going to become a lot more difficult before it actually gets better. Now, if that's the case, then obviously the leadership needs to be on the ball. The leadership needs to be in tip-top condition to lead the church through these difficult times that lie ahead. I've quoted Peter Jensen a couple of times, you know, when he was up here a few months back. He said, "It's been dusk so far, but we're about to enter the darkness." I think that's a prophetic word from a former Archbishop of Sydney. I think he's right. I think spiritually it's going to be very difficult for Christians in Australia in the years to come. And if that is so, and I hope I'm wrong, but if that is so, then the leaders are going to be in the firing line. They're going to be in the front line, just like Archbishop Porteous in Hobart. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of Hobart is before the courts now on an anti-discrimination charge. If things are going to get more and more anti-Christian, more and more difficult for Christians in Australia, then the leaders are going to be the ones who are going to be in the front line, in the firing line. And without godly leadership, the church will be in trouble. I mean, it's the same, really, I suppose, with any kind of group, whether it's Christian or not. If you have bad leadership, then you run aground, don't you? So if your soccer team isn't doing very well, if he keeps losing matches, what do? You sack the manager. So in any kind of walk of life, leadership is really very important. And in the church, bad leadership is disastrous, because we're not talking about dollars or football ratings. We're talking about souls. We're talking about people's spiritual lives and their eternal destiny. And so Peter turns his attention then to the leaders. This is what he says. You notice how the chapter opens. "To the elders among you I appeal as a fellow elder." Now notice he doesn't pull rank. He's not setting himself up as the Pope. He doesn't claim to be the Pope. He doesn't even claim to be the first amongst equals. He says, "To the elders amongst you, I appeal as a fellow elder." And he speaks, as I say, as a fellow elder, and he says, as a witness of Christ's sufferings, who will also share in the glory to be revealed. So Peter knows that if we're going to share in the glory to be revealed hereafter, and I wish, you know, as Christians, we would think more of the hereafter than we do, because our salvation is largely in the future. All we've got now are a few foretastes of what it's going to be like in the future. And Peter knows that glory is coming. And he knows that he's going to share in that glory that is coming, but in the meantime, he's going to have to suffer. How does he know that? Because Jesus told him. He learned that lesson at Caesarea Philippi, didn't he, when he tried to cancel out the cross. When he said to Jesus, "That'll never happen to you, Lord. You're not that kind of a Messiah." And Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." He never forgot that lesson. That suffering and glory are twins. These are the twin realities for us. Suffering now, glory later. That's the theme of his letter, really. Could sum it up in those two words. Suffering now, glory later. And the leaders, then, are particularly in the firing line when it comes to suffering now. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one of the leaders of the Confessing Church in Germany during the Second World War. And his friends persuaded him to escape to America, which he did. He went in July, I think it was 1939. He went to America, but he came back. Just as the war was breaking out and the clouds were gathering, he decided to come back to Germany. And this is what he said: I shall have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. That's a leader. I've got no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. He chose suffering with his people, and as you know, eventual martyrdom right at the very end of the war. He was put to death. He was executed. And at a time, you see, when morale is crumbling amongst Christians, when the church is about to experience, here in Peter's time, the first official state persecution, Peter appeals to the leaders. And he appeals to the Christian leaders like himself to stand firm, not to desert their posts, and to provide leadership for the flock of God. And that's always a relevant appeal to leaders in church, because sometimes it's a pretty thankless task to be a leader in a church. What kind of leadership does a church need? What kind of leadership does this church need? Any church. Look what Peter says. How does he address the leaders there of these churches? "Be shepherds," he says, "of God's flock that is under your care." Be shepherds. That's the job description of an elder in the Presbyterian Church. Be shepherds. Shepherds feed. Shepherds lead. Shepherds guard. That's what they do. Those three things. They feed, they lead, they protect the sheep. In fact, the way they lead is by feeding and by going ahead of the sheep. In the East, the shepherd goes ahead of the sheep. In the part of the world I come from, the shepherd follows the sheep. But in the Middle East, shepherds go ahead of the sheep, and the sheep follow the shepherd. And that's the picture here. That's what Peter has been recommissioned to do. Remember, "Peter, do you love me? Do you really love me, Peter? Well, feed my sheep. Tend my flock. Take care of the lambs." That's what leadership in the church is about. Be shepherds of God's flock. Richard Baxter, who wrote a Christian classic called The Reformed Pastor, says this: "If Christ had committed to my keeping one drop of his blood in a fragile glass, how carefully and tenderly would I have preserved it? But he has committed to us those that he has purchased with his own blood, all of it. Shall we despise the blood of Christ, shall we think it was shed for those who are not worthy of our utmost care and attention? My fellow elders, because I'm an elder, and those who might be aspiring to eldership, and I hope some of you are, because those who desire the work of a bishop, Peter says, an overseer, desire a good thing. I hope it's something that some of you want to do. I hope some of you are thinking and praying about that. But my fellow elders here at Ann Street, this is for us. God's flock is under our care. These people, and I'm not going to say look around now, but these people are those for whom Christ died. We need to see each other like that, don't we? This congregation, these people, are those whom Christ has purchased for God with his own blood, and he has handed them over to us to care for them. And he tells us how to do that. You notice three things he says. First thing he says is this: make sure your motive for leadership is right. Do you see that in verse 2? Be shepherds of God's flock, watching over them, not because you must, but because you may, because you're willing, as God wants you to be. See, we should never force people into leadership in the church. That's been a big mistake in the Presbyterian Church in days gone by. We should never force people into leadership in the church. You should never take on a leadership role just out of a sense of duty, or just because the church has voted you into office, or just because there are so many places to fill and we need someone to do the job and nobody else is putting up their hand. You should never, ever aspire to be a leader like that. Do it because you must, not because you may, Peter says. Do it out of love for Jesus and for no other motivation. And get the purpose right as well. Do you see that there in verse 2 again? Not greedy, but eager. Not greedy for gain, not greedy for money, but eager to serve. Now, it's got very little to do with money, I can assure you of that. But sometimes, although that's not entirely irrelevant, when you look at the tele-evangelists and all those sort of false prophets who are fleecing the saints, fleecing the sheep on the airwaves every Sunday morning. There's loads of them. So it's not totally irrelevant. But in our kind of circles, it's really not got very much to do with money. Sometimes people want to be leaders not so much for the cash, but for the kudos, the status, the recognition. And Peter is saying, it's not about that. It's not about what you're going to get out of this. It's about what you're going to be able to put into it. It's not about getting. It's about giving. It's about investing in people's lives. There's investing time, investing emotionally, investing spiritually in people's lives. That's what it's about for eternity. That's when you're going to see the returns from your investment in eternity. And Peter is saying, do this job, not to get, but to give. Not greedy for gain, but eager to serve. It's servant leadership that he's talking about. And it matters how you do this. Not only our motivation and getting the purpose right, but the manner in which we do it is important as well. Do you see what he says? Verse 3, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Being a leader is not an excuse for throwing your weight around. I like the way Eugene Peterson paraphrases this. He says, not bossily telling others what to do, but tenderly showing them the way. That's what leadership is like. Tenderly showing them the way. Leading by example. And why is this so important? Well, because, look at verse 4, because Jesus is coming back and we'll have to give an account to him of our stewardship as leaders. When the chief shepherd appears, it says, the archbishop, there is an archbishop, it's Jesus. There is a senior pastor, there's only one senior. This is one of my pet hates, I mustn't go off at a tangent here. But I find that in so many church plants and so many new churches, you know, there's about 20 people in the congregation, and the pastor is now either the senior pastor, and there's nobody else, or the lead pastor. I want to say there is only one lead pastor, there is only one senior pastor in the Bible, and that's Jesus. He is the chief shepherd. The rest of us are just under-shepherds. And when the chief shepherd appears, we're told, then you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. So when Jesus comes back, there will be instant job satisfaction for those who have been in leadership in this church. You'll see those that you've prayed for, those that you've struggled with, those that you've witnessed to, you'll see them in glory. Now you might not see very much for your labors, your sleepless nights. Now you might not see very much to encourage you, nothing but perhaps discouragement, because very often what's happening spiritually in a congregation isn't that obvious. And all those sleepless nights, all those interrupted evenings, all those long session meetings, grappling with the needs of the congregation, and maybe sometimes you think, well, why on earth do we go through this? Why do we have to do this? Suffering now, glory to come. There will be people in eternity who will be your joy and crown because of what you invested in their lives. So that's the first thing. There's an appeal to our elders. I think the bottleneck in the Presbyterian Church of Australia is at the eldership level. We've got it wrong. We're recovering from that. We need to get it right if we're going to grow as a church in Australia. You've got to do it biblically. So, the second thing. So, okay, now the elders are off the hook. But you see, what destroys a church? Bad leadership destroys churches. We've seen that happen so often, haven't we? So often. I'm not pointing the finger at this church and the leaders here, but bad leadership destroys churches. But what else destroys churches? Unbridled ego. And that's the second thing here, isn't it, in the passage? A challenge to our ego. Look at verse 5. In the same way, Peter says, same way as he's been talking to the elders, he says, in the same way, you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but the word elder or presbyter, as it is in the Greek, isn't simply a description of an office in the church. That's how we think of it. That's where the word Presbyterian comes from, presbyter, elder. And we're a congregation that's governed by elders. That's the distinctive thing about Presbyterianism. But presbyter just means senior, older, an older person. So it's not just to do, obviously Peter is talking to those who are leading the church, but it's not just to do with office, it's to do with age. I think what Peter is doing here, Peter is addressing what you might call the generation gap. There's always been a generation gap. Nothing new about that. From the start, Christianity was a youth movement, if you think about it. You know, Jesus, the leader of the movement, was a young man in his 30s. And whenever there is evil or injustice or corruption in society, then a new movement is created, and there are protests and sit-ins and marches, and people out on the streets are often young people. And Peter says to the young Turks, to the angry young men in the churches, submit yourselves to your elders. That's not easy, is it, when you're young? And especially if an elderly mentality has taken over the church. That can be very frustrating. And that's not necessarily anything to do with age either. I've met some very elderly 20-year-olds stuck in a rut. And I know some very switched-on 70-year-olds. So this has got nothing to do with age. It's to do with attitude. And Peter is bridging the generation gap here. He's speaking to both the young and the old. He has something to say to them both. He tells He tells the elders, the older ones, the leaders, those in seniority, he says, don't dominate. Don't use your seniority to lord it over the flock. Serve, like Jesus, the good shepherd, who came not to be served, but to serve and lay down his life for the sheep. And then he says to the young men, and you young men, you respect these elders who are serving you. You submit to them. Submission and responsibility go together. Why should you submit to your leaders? Well, because they have a responsibility to take care of your soul. They're watching for your soul, and they will have to give an account to the chief shepherd. So all of you, he says, do you see that there? All of you. Doesn't matter what age you are, how old you are, where you fit in. All of you, he says, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. In most churches, and Ann Street is no exception, there will be at least four generations present, each influenced by different perceptions of how things should be done. And it's hard, isn't it, for the older generation sometimes to accept that how they do things is not necessarily the best way for succeeding generations. No, we've always done it this way. That is the death knell of any church. And it's hard for the younger generation not to become impatient and frustrated, especially when they're left out of the decision-making process. And that's what happens. You see it happening all over the place, don't you? And how are we to deal with that? Look what Peter says. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility. There's no doubt what he's thinking about there. I'm sure he's thinking about the upper room, isn't he? When Jesus, what did Jesus do? He clothed himself with a towel. And he got down on the floor and he washed there. He did what any one of them should have done, but they were all too proud to do it. It was beneath them. It was the job of the household slave. That when guests came in off the dusty streets, before they sat down to eat, the slave would go around and wash their feet. And there they were in the upper room. It was the night before the cross. And they're in the upper room. It's the Last Supper. And Jesus gets down from the table. He girds himself with a towel. He clothes himself with a towel. And he gets down on his hands and knees. And he washes the feet of his disciples. And he says to them, now look, if I've done this for you, you should do this for one another. And Peter never forgot that. Here it is again. All of you, he says, clothe yourselves with humility. Let that be the culture of this church. Humility. Not a groveling Uriah Heep, oh, I'm ever so humble sort of a humility, which isn't humility at all, it's pride. But a Jesus-like humility. See, humility is not thinking poorly of ourselves. Humility is not thinking of ourselves at all. Wouldn't it be great if church were like that? No prima donnas. No people, you know, whose feelings are hurt because this, because that. No, let's not think of ourselves at all. Let's clothe ourselves with humility. Let's stoop and serve one another. Wouldn't it be great if morning tea was like that? They're all working for other people's goods, genuinely interested in each other, genuinely concerned to show care and support to one another, young and old alike. No generation gap. There should be no generation gap in this church or in any church, only a regeneration gap. That's the only gap that I want to see in this church. Those who are born again and those who are not. All of you, Peter says, do what Jesus did in the upper room. Clothe yourselves with humility. Why? Because God resists the proud. See, there's a lot at stake in this, isn't there? I'm not just bumping my gums together this morning. You know, I'm not just doing what I do because this is how I earn a crust. There's a lot at stake here. Because if we don't become people like that, if we're not like this as a church, well, God will be against us. Do we want God against us? God resists the proud. He gives grace. Oh, how we need God's favor. How we need to see conversions in this congregation. How we need to see our young kids who we baptized this morning. How we need to see these children coming to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. People from the world being brought into the kingdom. We'll never see that. If God is against us, He resists the proud. He gives grace to the humble. So we have here an appeal to the elders, a challenge to our ego, and thirdly, a recognition of the enemy. You see how it all fits together? And why do we need elders? Why do we need under-shepherds? Why do we need not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as some do? Why do we need to keep coming under the Word of God? Why do we need to the discipline of the church? Why do we need to be gathered into folds? Because there's a predator prowling around on the loose. Do you see what he says? Verse 8, your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Why is he roaring? Because his days are numbered. There's a warning in the book of Revelation, isn't there, in chapter 12 of Revelation. Woe to the earth and to the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. My friends, those are the days that we're living in. Spiritually, that's whether we realize it or not, that's what we're in. We're in a spiritual warfare right now. These are the last days. The next thing that's going to happen is Jesus is going to come back. But in the meantime, the devil, your enemy, is filled with fury. He's a roaring lion because he knows that his days are numbered. But the great thing is this, Peter says, resist him. He's a defeated foe. Jesus conquered him on the cross. Jesus turned the tables on evil at Calvary. Jesus, to quote that great promise from Genesis chapter 3, with the bruised heel of his crucified humanity, Jesus stamped on the head of Satan. He's still writhing and wriggling and furious and angry, but he's defeated and his days are numbered. So you can resist him. He's the father of lies. So when he comes telling you his lies, what do? Resist him with the truth. He's the accuser of the brethren. So when he comes whispering to you, you're not much of a Christian. When he starts accusing you and reminding you of your past, what do? Remind him of his future. That's what you do. Resist him. Do you see what he says? Peter says, resist him, standing firm in the faith. That's how you beat the devil. Someone has said there are two views that we ought to cultivate as Christians. The devil's back and God's face. That's what Peter is saying here. The devil's back and God's face. Cast your cares upon him, he says, because he does care for you. And you notice that in verse 9, it's just an interesting sideline there, that in verse 9, that the battle that we're involved with, and we may not even be aware that we're in a battle, and that's sad, but the battle that we're involved with, it's the same battle that Christians face all around the world. You see that there in verse 9? Resist him, he says, standing firm in the faith, because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of sufferings. And often we don't think like that. We look at Christians in other parts of the world, and we look at Christians in developing countries sometimes, and we think, well, they've got it so tough, and we've got it so easy. We're the lucky ones. They have to cope with so much more than we do. But the strange thing is, that's not the way they see it at all. When they come here from places like the Sudan, they pity us. Do you know the kind of thing they say? We don't know how you stay Christian in Australia. We don't know how you can stand firm in your faith, surrounded as you are by all this materialism. Brothers, sisters, we're praying for you that your faith will not fail. We're the ones who are in danger. Serious danger. So we're in a spiritual warfare. Peter appeals to the leaders. He challenges our ego. This isn't about you. Church isn't about you. He reminds us of the enemy. We're in a spiritual warfare. We're to stand firm in the faith and we're to resist the enemy. We're not to be ignorant of his devices. We're not just to, you know, when things happen to disrupt a fellowship, we're not just to say, oh, well, you know, that's the way things are, or that's so-and-so, that's the way she is or he is. Or No. We're not to be ignorant of the devil's devices. There's something going on here. But then finally, for our encouragement, he leaves us with this P.S. It is a P.S. I think Silas probably wrote the letter. And he leaves us with these few words. Look at verses 10 and 11. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you've suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. To him be the power forever and ever. Amen. What a great way to end a letter. And when Peter adds this postscript, probably in his own handwriting, verse 12, with the help of Silas, whom I regard as a faithful brother, I've written to you briefly, encouraging you and testifying that this is the true grace of God. What will God do for us? Peter uses four different verbs to describe it. He will restore us. He will make us strong. He will make us firm. He will make us steadfast. And he says it's all by his grace. So do you worry whether you'll survive as a Christian? Well, this is our survival kit. Think of 1 Peter as our survival pack. Things are going to get a whole lot more difficult for us in the future, I think. And Peter says, this is what you need to know. He's shown us the need for godly leadership so that the church won't go astray. He's shown us the need for humble dependence, an attitude of humility towards others and humbling ourselves before God. I don't want to lay guilt trips on people, but I don't see that in the sense that we're not praying. If we really were dependent on God. See, there's a phenomenon that you sometimes notice in ministry. There's something called what I call the Superman syndrome. You know, the desire to leap over tall buildings, and it's a kind of Messiah complex. You know, and if there's a problem, I'll fix it. And I see that in a lot of churches. I see that in the church planting movement. I see it. You know, there are a lot of I'm the guy you need, and you need to follow this program. You follow this program, and then the church will grow. And if it's not growing, it's because you're not following this, and so on. That's all. That's not us depending on God. That's not us seeking God's face. How do you seek God's face? You come to a prayer meeting. You come together as a church. You say, God, unless you do something here, we're finished. So godly leadership, humble dependence, resistance against the enemy, realizing that we are in a real spiritual warfare. Let's not have this silly sacred spiritual divide. So, you know, spiritual things don't count in the real world. That's the way people do it. People shrug off this thing sometimes. They say, oh, well, I don't want you hiding in the Bible or hiding behind Bible verses. You know, why not? We're under the authority of the Bible, aren't we? You can't have, you know, your life in church and your life out of church as if they were two separate watertight compartments. Godly leadership, humble dependence, resistance against the enemy, but finally, God's grace. Knowing that God is gracious and powerful enough to bring us through to heaven. The grace of God, says Peter. This is the true grace of God. Stand fast in that. We can never deserve it. We'll always stuff up. We can always come back. This is the true grace of God. He'll always restore us, just as he restored Peter. He'll always establish us and make us firm. This is the true grace of God. Stand fast in it.